Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. I'm Molly Martin, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Darrellyn Evans. Welcome, Darrellyn.
Good morning, Molly.
Good morning.
Super pro thing of taking a giant bite of chocolate right as you were doing the intro, so I'm going to chew on that for just a minute.
It was a very well-timed intro. I will tell our listeners that we are bi-coastal today. So Darrellyn is on the West Coast and I am on the East Coast. Well, sort of in New Englandish. Normally I'm on the East Coast. Anyways, we've got the U.S. covered.
Full coverage. So how are you, Molly? I haven't seen you or talked to you for a couple weeks.
I'm good. I'm very excited to hear about your writer's retreat. But before that, because I'm more excited to hear about you, so I want you to talk longer. So I'll just tell you my news real quick.
Okay.
I got my edits back from the editor, 17 pages of notes, really great suggestions. He helped me brainstorm. There's a couple of story mechanics that I was not happy with. And he was also very complimentary about a writer problem that I think I've had this whole time. And he said, no, basically, that's not the problem you have. It's a different thing, which is actually much more easily correctable. So this is like going to the doctor and thinking that, you know, you have some terrible disease. And they're like, actually, you just have a cold and here's some, you know, Flonase or something.
Oh, that's awesome. So this is on book two of your trilogy.
Yes. So this is book two of the trilogy. Book one is Survivor's Club and book two is Ashfall. And I'm debating on what I actually want to call the series. So if anybody has any good thoughts, let me know.
Okay.
Awesome. Series by committee.
Oh, so I want to dig in a little more to make you talk longer about what is that writer problem you thought you had?
Okay, so I have frequently been told in various feedback settings that my characters don't have a lot of emotion. And I have always felt that that was not the case. Like, I think my characters have lots of emotions. And I always thought, you know, it's very clear that they have emotions. Their emotions are on the page. And what the editor said is he also agreed. He said, you know, obviously your characters have lots of emotions. Their emotions are on the page. I can see what their emotions are. He said, what probably you're getting this feedback four is that your readers are having problems attaching and identifying with these characters. So even though the characters are having emotions, the readers aren't. So it's a slightly different problem. But he gave me some good ideas about how to fix that. And one of the things we talked a lot about is because my story has multiple point of views and multiple different storylines that are kind of different plot lines that are interweaving. He had talked about how it's sort of similar to things like Game of Thrones or The Walking Dead, where you have multiple characters and multiple storylines. But the problem is that then it makes it hard for the reader to get, or, you know, whoever, to get attached or interested in any particular storyline if you're constantly jumping from that storyline to a different one. So they might really, really like this one character, but then that character goes away for four chapters and they don't see them again. And they're like, I really, really wanted to read about this other character. I don't care about, you know, four chapters of these other characters. And so now I'm mad at you as the writer.
Mm. And what is his thought on fixing that?
So he had a couple of suggestions. The one that I like the best, which solves a couple of book problems, is to combine some plot lines and get characters together. So instead of having four different plot lines with four characters going in four different directions, to either get all four of them together or two of them together, you know, put them in two pairs, and just kind of get them together more. And the other thing that will solve is it will cut down the word count, because then I won't be writing four different storylines. I'll be writing one storyline or two, or possibly, you know, possibly three, because at one point one of the characters is going to have to go off by themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
It's nice to know there is, well, it's good to have that outside feedback from folks who have been looking at that for so long so that you can get that perspective. So,
yeah. Mom. And like I said, I've gotten that feedback a lot in particular about that story is people say, you know, well, I don't think the characters have a lot of emotion. And I'm like, they're emoting all over the place. Like, I can't make them emote anymore without it being, you know, telenovela drama kind of levels of emotion. So it was very frustrating to me because I felt like I'm doing all the writer things. Like, they're having physical signs of emotion. They are, you know, having thoughts and feelings about their, you know, kind of internal monologues about their emotions. I'm like, they're having emotions, I swear to God.
they're just not having them close enough together to their last chapter.
Yeah.
Cool. Very exciting.
Yeah. And so now you can't wriggle out of it anymore. You get one more question and then I was just going to say,
and any other things? So you've been in the middle. So I guess, how is that affecting your writing right now? What did you go off and do while you were waiting for the edits? And then now that you have the edits back, what does writing life look like right now? Is it, because you also have book three there, are you writing for book three at the same time as doing edits? Is that like, do you split your day, or is it today is edits and tomorrow is new words?
So what I had done while I was waiting for book two to come back from the editor is I had stopped working on book three because my suspicion was that the editor was going to suggest lots of changes. And I didn't want to go forward with book three because if things changed drastically in book two, then all of that work would be for naught in book three because, you know, there might be different characters that are dead or different events that have happened. And so I actually pulled up a different novel that I had written about maybe a year or two before Survivors Club and then kind of, you know, stuck in the virtual drawer and not looked at it for a number of years. And I pulled that back out and started rereading it. And it's like, you know what, this is pretty good. It's basically Hogwarts for assassins. So
I love it.
I know. I'm so excited about it because I love assassin stories and spy stories. It's kind of like spies and assassins. And, you know, they have powers and there's evil government conspiracies. It's a lot of fun. So I started reading it over. And I'm a very arrogant writer when I read my own stuff because I'll write it and I'm like, this is terrible, it's so awful, it's so bad. And then I'll come back about a month later and read it over and go, this is just pure genius.
But it is genius, Molly. That's why we love you.
Oh, thank you. You're so sweet.
Cool. Well, it's great to have another project sitting over there to work on. So
yeah.
Can't wait to read more of that.
It's just more creative procrastination, really.
But in a forward direction, because you'll have a different book at the end, right?
Yeah. Well, that's my book.
A whole new book, blah, blah.
That's my book that I'm trying to get up the nerve to query my dream agent for the book. Yeah.
Okay, so you had a post about that last week. Send it or not. So have you sent the query?
I have not, but I have not revised it anymore. So I'm not revising it. So I don't think that counts as procrastinating.
Okay. So what is making you pause, and how do we help you send that query, or what's the next step if it's not send the query?
Well, here's my quasi legitimate excuse for not sending the query is that the first half of the book is in really good shape. And after that, there are good plot points in the book, but it's really poorly transitioned between those scenes and plot points. Because I wrote it is also a product of a NaNoWriMo year. So I wrote the last half of it quite quickly, and I need to smooth over those transitions. So I'm procrastinating with the assumption that once I do query my dream agent, she will immediately request the entire manuscript. And so I have to have it ready to send to her. So that's my excuse. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll give you a month on that and check back in.
Okay. Yes. And it's September now, so we'll have to check in October.
Uh-huh. It'll probably be September by the time we get this up. Uh-huh. We're going. That's funny. Cool. Oh, well, it sounds like lots of exciting things, but you're going to have a little bit of dishevel in the next several weeks, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. We're going to be going through a pretty big move in the end of June, beginning of July.
Okay. So you have
which will be difficult considering now it's now September, so we're just going to go back into time and retroactively move.
Uh-huh.
It's good to be a Time Lord.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll have to think about ways to keep the writing productivity going during the move, because that's life keeps interrupting writing. That's our perpetual dilemma, right?
Or in your case, writing has interrupted life for a little bit. I want to hear about this fabulous retreat to the seaside.
Okay. So we had the great privilege to host and attend the Fiction Fluency Retreat in Yahats, Oregon, with Eric Witchie, which was amazing and wonderful. pardon me. We went, let's see, so we spent an entire week in Yahats in this giant house that was, it could not have been set up more perfectly for a writer's retreat. It had like giant living room upstairs, and then it had a second one downstairs so everybody could really spread out and do their work. But the main focus on the retreat, so Eric Witchie is teaching a year-long seminar series called Fiction Fluency, and everyone at the retreat had taken Fiction Fluency at some point over the last couple years. And so what the retreat was about is this opportunity to really deep dive and immerse ourselves into the concepts of fiction fluency and apply them. So the challenge with even seminars as great as Eric's are that you're sitting there doing a lot of learning, and he does try to build in some practice and some writing and exercises into the seminars. But then you still go away for a month in between each seminar, and you don't have that direct daily application with the group or with Eric to talk about the concepts and talk about, you know, and really look at how they apply. So we had basically an entire week of applying those concepts to everyone's stories. And so, and it was split in a really interesting way. We, every morning we would get together, we would all have read a story and analyzed it and looked at it through the lens of the fiction fluency concepts and then go through it. And I'll back up and explain a little bit about particularly what we were looking at. So Eric has three controlling statements is what he calls them. So as you're writing or as you're revising or analyzing a story, he's looking basically at these three things. The first is premise, and then character arc, and the irreconcilable self. And so we're looking at story through the lens of these three things and how they control the story, and with the understanding that, like, when a story is off or it's not working, it's usually because that one of these three controlling statements breaks at some level of the story. And then he has a way to look through the story. So you're looking overall at the premise, and premise comes from Lajos Agri's The Art of Writing, I believe it's called. And premise is that controlling statement that the story or play or film or novel proves. And that is, some emotion, sociological state and psychological states leads to an end result, emotional state, sociological state, and psychological state. Those are, and so Eric always uses the example of Romeo and Juliet, where the statement is, you know, young infatuation, romantic infatuation leads to suicide and social change. So at the beginning we have, you know, Romeo's in love with Rosalind. He thinks he's in love, and the families, the two families, are at war with each other. And that emotional state and psychological state leads to, you know, bodies on the stage and the two warring families realizing they can no longer have this war. So, so that's kind of what the story is proving, this statement. And it's really interesting to be able to spend a lot of time looking at, and I'm saying that poorly, but to really understand and grasp that concept of premise and look at how it is working through a story, and to be able to take, so we had 10 writers there, to be able to take everyone's stories, and some of them did multiple stories, so we did, you know, 12 or 13 stories, and really look at how premise is working all the way through the stories. Is it, and if it breaks, where does it break? And really grasp that concept. So I was super happy about that. And then character arc and irreconcilable self, of course, the other aspects of that, and in particular, irreconcilable self is it's kind of a catch 22 that the character believes two irreconcilable aspects about themselves that, you know, for day-to-day life, as long as they are not coming into contact with each other, they do just fine. But as soon as, you know, the story, if story is really about character, emotion, and change, so if a character is, you know, if the story is really about character change and character emotion, then as soon as those irreconcilable aspects of themselves come into conflict, the character is forced to either, you know, choose one of those irreconcilable things over the other, or you know, choose one, choose the other one, choose both, you know, figure out how to make them work together or get rid of them and find a new way of being. And these are super deep emotional drivers. The like, I am a really good family man and I'm a really good assassin, or and as soon as somebody must choose over those two things, then and he always uses the professional as his example, that you know, whatever the guy's name is a really good assassin. Leon. But then as soon as as soon as the little girl comes into his life and he chooses to protect her, he is a good family man, and so he has to choose between those two things. Will he protect her and be a good family man, or will he be a good assassin, which is to cause harm to her? So it's a really interesting dilemma, and it forces the character into a lot of deep uncomfortable conflict that is then acted out on the page. So then we just spent all of that glorious time going through and looking deeply at story for those things and seeing how at each layer, so you look overall story, and then you begin to look at movements of the story. Does the premise connect through, or does the reconcilable self, like, and the connect, or the character arc, I'm sorry. But then really looking at, when a story is working on those levels, when you can get down to even the sentence and paragraph level of saying, okay, in this paragraph, which, you know, is this sentence reflecting which side of their reconcilable self or which side of the premise? And then you can really see how that transitions through the story, or is it balanced, those kinds of things. So it's fascinating. I'm doing a terrible job of saying that this was a magical retreat, and the real gift of it was that ability. Well, everyone had all of the concepts, so that was pretty magnificent, but also just that opportunity to take all of these concepts and really immerse and apply them, rather than just sitting in a class and learning, which is, of course, wonderful, and we need to do that. But to have that gift of time to really just sit and apply all of that knowledge in this very concentrated place where, in theory, we had no distractions, and housework and all of those, you know, life, all of those kinds of things intervening. So I have to say, it was what was amazing, not just for myself to feel like I really leveled up, but to watch everyone else really grasp the concepts and level up and just get so excited about their work and really seeing possibilities in their stories. Pardon me. So it was pretty good.
It sounds amazing.
It was amazing.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we're all like, oh, we have to do this again very, very soon. So
yes.
So you must come join us.
I wish.
Not I wish. We need to make it so. But that got me thinking about how important it is. Well, just trying to think of ways to make sure that we can apply, you know, so we take lots of classes and I think like that is driven out of that need to let, you know, we want to learn more and we want to improve our craft, but then being really intentional when we walk out of that and how to apply it every day, you know, like really thinking about as you're deciding to take a class or to take, you know, even just a little one-off workshop or something, that you plan ahead to carve out time to really apply that.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the challenges. We get really excited. We go to a conference or we go to a, you know, we have a class and we get really excited about all the things that we learned, but then it kind of like, oh, but how do I take this out into my daily practice? And,
I think that ties back to one of our recent conversations. We were talking about a space, like a space of your own, a room of your own, or a space to write in, and how important it is to have that place, or at least a frame of mind, if it's not a specific place that you can get into and write. And the nice thing about something like a retreat is that it's kind of enforced upon you. And what it was making me think about is, There are schools nowadays that have taken the philosophy that there should not be homework, that basically all of the students' work should be done at school. And then when they go home, you know, they're done with the school, with the academic portion of their day. And I kind of like the idea of, you know, having a place tied with the activity, because then you're not, you know, in school mode in school, and then you go home and you're thinking, like, here's all the cues that say I should be in home mode, but you still have to be in school mode. And I think for writers, it works the same way, is that, you know, at a conference or a class or a retreat, we're in writer mode. But then we go home and we're like, well, I'm not in writer mode anymore. So how do we carry
laundry
that?
Laundry mode.
Yeah. How do we carry that writer mode with us? Or do more classes need to sort of bake in some practical exercise time to just like get you to do the techniques with your training wheels on and the instructors right there to help you be successful, so that you have that reinforcement? Like, not only do I understand the concept, but I can do the concept. And even if I need a little bit of help to do it here, I've succeeded at it. So when I go and do it by myself, I'm confident that I can.
Yes.
So many possibilities.
Yeah, so we just need to revolutionize all of the writing training.
Yes.
Which, actually, I think a lot of writers, we do try to do that. And I know even in the classes that I teach, I always try to have the exercises. But it is important to you know, have that take-home sheet. You know, here are some ways to input that I need to be better about. You're right. But maybe even, you know, do a little bit less in class, but do a lot more exercises just to make sure we're really instilling those concepts.
Yeah, I think, it depends on what the topic is too. I mean, sometimes like you just need to give them some base knowledge and be like, okay, here it is. Take your worksheets and go. I was thinking about I'm doing this thing where I'm writing a series of blog posts and trying to explore structure of story and getting into the evil mindset of of dastardly plotters and how do they do the nefarious things that they do, which is a mystery to us gangsters. And so I'm exploring this through a series of blog posts, and the most recent one was on the dynamic, I believe, the dramatic question. So it's basically the second major point in your story. So the first point in your story is kind of the setup of, like, this is what's going on. Like, the dragon comes to the village, or, you know, Gandalf shows up in the Shire, or whatever. There's, like, this is what the problem is. And a lot of times you might see this, like, in a James Bond movie or something like that. It's like that little prologue piece where he kills somebody in the bathroom with a pen, and then it, you know, has the cool opening and you go on to something else. But the next piece of the story is really, like, what is the story about? And so I had actually referenced Eric Ritchie's use of premise of, you know, X plus Y leads to Z. Of, you know, X is this, X is, you know, in the example of Romeo and Juliet, X is two feuding families, or X is, you know, young love, and, you know, two feuding families leads to, you know, death and social change, or whatever.
Despair and suicide and social change.
There you go. Much more eloquently put. So the example that I used was the premise from my book is that the desire to cure various diseases coupled with corporate greed leads to, you know, pandemic and so forth and so on. And so that's kind of the basic premise of my book. But I had some fun exploring premise in a couple other books to just see if I could figure out what the premise is. And knowing that, okay, this book does have a premise, and you can find it, and you can look at it, and then you can think about the intentionality of maybe, as a panster, like, I don't necessarily start with a premise, but what I want to do is by the end of my first draft, that premise should be clear. Even if it's not clear when I start, it needs to be clear to me by the end. And then during my revision, I can go back through and make sure that I'm aligning along that premise. So whether you're a plotter or a panster, you're still going to have premises. Just for plotters, I think they have premise first and work from there. And pansters, premise will emerge during the course of your writing. And then you need to, like, work it back into what you're doing.
That sounds just like what how Eric is talking about using premise. And particularly so I think he is a lot more like, of course he's internalized story structure at this point, but he is much more of a pantser than a plotter overall, I think. He does part of the fiction fluency is to show that you can use these structures either way. You can, you know, use premise and character arc and a reconcilable self to plot a story out, you know, I don't think plot is quite the word, but, you know, to really outline a story. But you can also go in afterwards and say, okay, here's my big pile of clay from my pantser draft, and how do I then apply this? So that sounds really smart.
Clay is a nicer word than what I would have used, but we'll go with that.
Yeah. Compost heap. No. Yes, he's got, so that sounds like a really smart application of that. And I should say, I realize in talking earlier about the retreat, I forgot kind of an important piece that Eric also talks about, and that is he has a big piece about working with writers groups, and his thing is that you are not at a writers group A to get a critique to make your writing better, or B to critique someone else's work to help them make that work better. What you're really there for, deep down, is to get raw material to analyze and use these tools to help you as the writer understand story. So even though, yes, with hope you will do an effective analysis of the story and let them know, you know, here as for me as a reader and how I'm analyzing your story, here's what I see that's working and that is not working as effectively, so that it might help the writer or, you know, the person who wrote the piece fix it. But really, it's about you as a writer learning how to analyze stories so that you are seeing all of these concepts at these different levels and how they're working or when they break, and then your thoughts on how to fix them based on what your understanding of premise or character arc or reconcilable self are for the story. And being able to learn how to see, well, the story doesn't feel like it's working because the premise doesn't add up, or the premise breaks in the second movement, or you know, it starts with the sense that the irreconcilable self is this one thing, but at the end it's this entirely, you know, like this piece of the irreconcilable self doesn't really get reconciled, or it doesn't, you know, like it kind of goes away. And so it's something you were just saying of going in and looking at stories that are working and seeing how these pieces are working, I think is another part of that, is like really learning how to analyze. And, you know, when you learn a concept, go and take a bunch of stories that are published that are in theory working, and see how they're working and see why they're working. I think that's an important piece. And then, of course, try to find a writer's group where you can dig in and do and try to do this analysis there as well. And now, that's not to say you can't help a writer find things. And of course, you know, we do value that. But it also helps you as if you are the person receiving the critiques and people are just saying, well, I like this, or, oh, you know, they're not, the emotions aren't working for me, or they're just, you know, they're not having emotions. You will have the tools now to be able to analyze, you know, look at their analysis. Like, are they truly deeply analyzing it? And and with hope, they will illuminate something for you. But if not, if it's this general, I didn't get it, I didn't like it, you know, they're not emoting when you know they're emoting all over the place. that's not terribly helpful. And so it gives you different tools to be able to go, okay, well, if they're feeling they're not emoting, then you can go in and say, what is it that feels like it? Or as someone who is an effective analyzer to help you with that.
Well, yeah, you as the writer can look at it and say, you know, I don't feel connected to this character, but I can see from what is on the page, like, and it has to be on the page, so it still counts.
Right.
It doesn't count if it's not on the page. So I can see from what's on the page, you know, the character is either physically showing signs of sadness, or they're thinking about how sad they are, or, you know, in some other ways it's conveyed that they're sad. But if I, as the reader, don't feel, you know, the sadness that the character is in the tragic situation, you know, then kind of examining these things from the perspective of, you know, premise, character arc, and irreconcilable self, you can look at it and say, okay, if I'm not connecting with this thing like I should be from the writer's intent, why am I not connecting with it? And that's going to be enormously valuable to the writer, because then you can say, I didn't connect with it, and here is why. So if you fix this, if you, you know, maybe it's that they're coming to some kind of crisis with their irreconcilable self, that the two parts of themselves are supposed to be in conflict, but that conflict hasn't been foreshadowed enough, or it hasn't been clarified enough, so that you don't feel when they do come into conflict, you're like, well, that's not really that big of a deal. Like, if my conflict is, I'm a barista, but I actually like tea, that's not really that big of a conflict. I mean, it could be. And and if you want to be a challenge, go ahead and write that story of why those two things are irreconcilable. But for me, I'd be like, okay, but, you know, like, I'm not going to worry about it that much as a reader. So I need a stronger irreconcilable self.
Yeah.
So it's more of, I think of it as like, and again, it's me as a panster. I think of those as more diagnostic tools than tools to help me with my first draft. And it just, so I've taken Eric's classes, and they're enormously helpful. And I start with many good intentions of having irreconcilable self and character arc and premise and all of those things. And then my story just wanders off in a completely different random direction. So then once I finish, then I can use those as diagnostic tools. But I think if you're a plotter, having these premise, character arc, and irreconcilable self as you're plotting
will make sure that your story is much more robust and that it's much more internally consistent and that you are tugging on the heartstrings at the right places and getting people to throw their books across the room at the right places.
We never
and
throw
all
books.
Of that.
So we never throw books. Okay, maybe once.
Okay, maybe it's just me then. Not library books, but my own.
Yes, only when they're making really dumb choices. No, don't do it. We are going to make a plotter out of you yet. Molly Martin. No, I think you're right though. That is exactly what the tools work both ways and help you. But I think also the more that you are writing and internalizing these, the more that they'll just come out naturally for you.
Yeah.
That you'll be able to tap into that innately to use them. So
yeah, I just focus on it a lot because as a panster, I think that like my reaction to it, anytime somebody tells me like, here's a tool to help you write better, my first thought is, screw you, I don't need that. I'm a genius. Everything I write is pure magic. Because that's, I think, in a lot of ways, I think that's how pansters tend to write is, you know, it's the first draft is kind of pure magic to us. And we don't want to look at what's under the hood a lot of times. Like, we don't want to stop along the way and you know, we don't want to map out our journey. We just want to get in the car and go. Mm-hmm. And I think for us, then having those tools and being able to accept that those tools are useful to us, but in a different way than they're useful to plotters is really helpful. It's not that those tools aren't good. It's just, we need to use them differently.
Yes.
All right. I'll put my soapbox away.
Okay.
We'll have to cut.
So I think our next topic is going to be about writer resistance. Which we'll do, and we can talk about it in many ways. So
yeah, right, that will be fun.
Yeah. So before we head out into our writing lives, do you have an editing tip for us this week?
I do, and I'm just going to steal shamelessly from the things that we've already talked about, is that my editing tip is, no matter whether you're a plotter or a panster, you need to go through and figure out what is the dramatic question of your story or what is the premise of your story, and look for instances that premise is proved true or that premise is proved false, or in the case of if you want to think of it as a dramatic question. So the dramatic question could be, does absolute power always corrupt? And there may be points in your story where you say, you know, here's an example of a character who has power but is not corrupted by it. So then the premise is proved false. There might be other instances where the character is a very good character and then is corrupted by that power, thus proving it true. And at the end of it, you as the writer get to decide, do you believe that or not? So use those diagnostic tools in your editing.
Mm-hmm. When you're doing that, how do you do that? Do you print out a copy and go down the margin and write it in, or do you use a spreadsheet? Do you move, you know, do you take what you've written and then like card it out and do that work on cards? Like where do you do that?
Well, one of the things that I do, and I know writers, again, writer resistance, writers are not terribly thrilled about the idea of writing a synopsis, but I write a synopsis after I finish a novel, and I just write a synopsis of what I think I wrote. It's like a book report for myself. So I do a book report on my book of what I think I wrote. And then when I go through and I'm editing, I look for places where what I actually wrote is different from what I think I wrote. And most of the time, it needs to be fixed to align with what I think I wrote. And occasionally it's just like a brilliant mistake and I have to leave it in there. But that, you know, that guides me in my revisions of having a synopsis of what was my intent. And again, as a plotter, you know, or as a panster, I know plotters have this ahead of time. You know, you have your blueprint of what do I want to write
and pansters have to reverse engineer it of what did I want to do without knowing it, and then what did I actually do? So write your synopsis, and then as I go through my synopsis, I look for reversals. So in my premises, so let's say, again, using the example of absolute power corrupts. So my story is intended to prove that it doesn't, that good characters can resist the power, the lure of being corrupted, but can still use power to accomplish good. So whenever a character uses their power and accomplishes good, but isn't corrupted by it, that's a win for them. And then I look for places where it's reversed and they use power and it's corrupting, and so then they lose. And I use that to help me track reversals in the story of, is the premise winning? Is the premise being proved true, or is it being proved false? And depending on what kind of story you're writing, you're going to have a different number of reversals. But there's a couple of great articles out there that talk about, I think Harry Potter in particular is a pretty well-known one, where they've diagrammed, there are like 13 or 19 major reversals or something like that. And that if you have around this number of reversals, that's kind of the standard number of reversals in a novel length story, is sometimes they're winning, sometimes they're losing. And that helps you track, are they winning and losing enough times for there to be some tension in your book?
Oh, I like that. That's really smart. Because yes, we do. We don't actually want them to win too much. We want to win just enough to keep us cheering for them. But
really, we want them to lose a lot more than they win. Like I would say, I and my thing is, I would like them to lose at least two or three times to every win.
Right. Yes. So that we can see that we have to turn the page and see, oh wait, how are they going to get out of this one?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And it doesn't necessarily, so that's kind of the other thing, is it doesn't necessarily have to be just your premise. So you have these three tools, the character arc, the irreconcilable self, and the premise. And winning or losing these reversals can happen on all of those levels. Like they can, one part of their irreconcilable self can be kind of ascendant, and then the other side can take over, and that'll be a reversal. So it's not necessarily that the plot is changing, but they're changing their stance.
Yes. Well, that's definitely how we're seeing that character arc evolve or develop, is how they're changing back and forth. And are they going to fall back into their old traps, or are they going to learn the thing and accomplish the thing? So good. Oh, that's an awesome tip. I think here, that was good.
Oh.
I'm going to start applying it right now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, do you have big plans for your writing week?
My big plans for my writing week are to actually outline, I know I said the bad word, to actually outline my second novel, considering the suggestions and revisions that my editor has given me.
Oh, cool. Very exciting.
I know. I'm a grown-up writer that has to actually outline.
No. Well, you're outlining after the fact, so that's like totally perfect, right?
Okay.
It fits into that pantser model of you don't outline till after. So. Cool.
How about you? Big plans for your writing?
I have a weekend off, and so I'm so excited because I can actually spend a little bit of time on some big writing. And reading, I fall off of reading for some reason. It's really hard to jam it in. Partly because I can't, I have to devour an entire book. I'm not someone who could read like 15 minutes here and there. Because even when I do, I'll just read one chapter before bed and then it's 4 a.m. I can't just sip at reading. I have to devour reading, which makes it kind of hard because it's in day-to-day life, it's hard to find 4 to 8 hour blocks to read a book.
It's unreasonable.
I know. So, but I have whole days off this week. Just the way that work worked the last, I worked basically 3 weeks in a row. So solid, straight. And so I finally have a little bit of time off. So I'm going to read a book and I am going to do some writing.
Well deserved. Yes.
Or bigger chunks of writing. So,
and I will say, like, we give a lot of advice about writing, and I think we don't talk enough about how reading is really important. It's not just fancy procrastination. It's actually part of your job as a writer.
Yes, absolutely. And reading, well, and just as you were talking about, reading to really, you know, read once for pleasure and then dive back into a book and see and really look at how it's working, get under the hood and say, okay, how is premise working? How is character arc working? You know, the reconcilable self, how are these reversals, whatever piece that you're trying to master, take several stories that you've just read and dive in and see how they're doing it. It's a great idea. So
yeah, I try that with Red Rising occasionally and it just never works. Like I get two or three chapters in and I totally forget what I was supposed to be looking at. I'm like, and then I'm done with the series.
Yes. But speaking of reversals, if you ever want to see and somebody who is so good at putting these characters into situations where, along with reversals, the yes, but, no, and. So if the character wins, it's a yes, but things get worse. And mm-hmm. if the character loses, it's no, and things get worse. And he is master of that. It's just like, oh, wait, but now this, like, how are they even possibly going to get out of this? And they do, and it's still worse. It's amazing. He is a master of that.
I know.
And I say that, I did not want to like those books, and they are not my genre, and they are not the thing I read at all, and man, those are good books. And I hate him. No, he's totally, I admire him greatly. He's amazing. And I'm only a little bit jealous. So anyway, okay. Well, happy writing and happy house searching and all of those things. And
yep.
We'll talk to you next week.
Hi, everybody.
Bye. This has been Sentenced to Paragraph. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye.